Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 19th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, When is a Mouse Not a Mouse? Presented by Grant Thorsett. Disc number THG-2005-02.
Just some brief comments about altering the genetic makeup of a species by selective breeding or by genetic engineering. But then the gist of the day morning will be dealt with these other topics. What are transgenic or genetically modified organisms, called GMOs for obvious reasons, genetically modified organisms. You often might see them called GEOs for genetically engineered organisms. I tend to use the GMOs through here. And, you know, we'll talk about what they are, why we want to produce them, briefly how we produce them, and then give some examples of what has been done in production of transgenic organisms and some of their uses as we go. So if we, I was told this is very touchy. You've got to aim it just perfectly. There we go. I'm used to one where you can sort of turn this way from the computer and bounce it off of a board and it still works. And so I may be pointing it the wrong way a few times. Selective breeding, of course, has been going on since the beginning of the agricultural age with crop plants, and especially with animals. You know, people have known for a long time that certain kinds of breeding combinations would give you the kinds of results you want. That's my example yesterday. If you want goats that produce a lot of milk, you breed ewes that produce a lot of milk to rams that have a history of producing ewes that produce a lot of milk. And this is a slow process, and it's an imprecise process, because during production of egg and sperm, the genetic content of an animal is cut in half in a random way, in the sense that in humans we have 46 chromosomes and gametes have 23, one of each type. But you're going to get a blend of maternal and paternal chromosomes, maternal and paternal traits. And so you have half the genetic information of each of the parents in the progeny. So it's rather imprecise. And genes interact with each other in ways that are sometimes unpredictable. So it's slow, it's limited to transferring genes, of course, between the same species. Definition of the biological species is they have the capacity to interbreed. And so you can't go beyond species lines in these transfers. Whereas with a... Look, now I'm going to be in trouble. You know what to do. Thank you very much. Back arrow for me. I had... That's right. We'll go one more forward. You'll probably have to do that more than once. I had John sitting there under that yesterday. He had hit it about three different times when that happened. But if we do use molecular biotechnology techniques and genetic engineering, we can select for specific genes. We don't get a bunch of genes. We can get a single gene for a particular trait that we want. So it's very precise, as opposed to just selective breeding, and you can cross species lines. You can put elephant genes into corn plants if you want to. So that's an advantage in many cases. As we'll see, that there's been so much crossing of species lines. A transgenic organism, this an organism that has genes from two different species, and typically the result of some genetic process. Why do we do it? Well, various reasons. You might want to enhance some particular trait in an animal or a plant. You might want to produce a pharmaceutical product. And we'll see the pharmaceutical industry is very much into this business of transgenic organisms. One of the goals of the whole field of biotechnology, a major goal down the line, as far as many people are concerned, is the development of gene replacement therapy in humans so that we could correct human genetic diseases, and we have to learn how to do those technologies. You don't learn how to do those by experimenting on the human species, but by carrying out processes in various kinds of animals. You can learn the technology before you apply it to a human. And then the scientists would use these techniques often to more readily understand certain biological processes, whether they're processes related to the development of an organism, what are the events that go on as an embryo develops through a fetal stage into an adult. There are certain genes that have to be turned on and turned off, et cetera, in proper order, and trying to learn the science, the biology, if you will, of the process. We often utilize transgenic organisms. I say we, and I've never used one other than transgenic bacteria, but that's a royal bee or something. There you go again. This slide shows basically how a plant can be modified genetically. We start I think the most commonly used method of transferring genes into a plant makes use of a bacterium called Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which is a bacterium that causes a particular disease condition in a variety of plants, the one called crown gall disease. And what it basically is, the disease symptom, as far as the plant is concerned, if infected with this bacterium, is to produce an abnormal growth, a tumor. So it's a tumor-inducing bacterium. And the gene to produce that tumor lies on a piece of DNA in a bacterial cell called a plasmid. It's a small piece of DNA that some bacteria have. And in this plasmid, there's it's called the TI plasmid, for tumor-inducing plasmid. And there's a gene there that interferes with the normal growth pattern of the cells of the plant and stimulates continual growth and develops into a tumor. And it does that by inserting itself, this whole plasmid, including the gene, into the DNA in the nucleus of the host cell. And so this plasmid becomes part of the DNA of the plant. And that gene gets expressed and makes a tumor. But the way that this is utilized, and I do have a colleague that does do, Ab Willamette, that does do some of this kind of work, botanist, that the way you introduce that gene is you cut open this plasmid right in the middle of the gene. That destroys the gene, so it doesn't cause the tumor, and you insert in its place a foreign piece of DNA that you cut out from another organism, and it can be inserted chemically into that plasmid. This plasmid gets taken up into the cell of the target plant and inserts this DNA, but that includes the gene of interest. And so this gene then has been inserted. It doesn't cause a tumor, but the cell, that cell, and the cells from which are derived from that, I should say, will now carry that gene. Now, one thing about plants that makes the genetic engineering much more feasible, gene insertion much more feasible than in animals, is that many plant species will grow from a single cell. So you can take a single cell, modify it, and then grow that in the proper nutrient environment with the right kinds of hormones, and it will start to develop and ultimately differentiate itself into having root, stem, and leaf structures and become a mature plant. And if you do that, then every cell in that plant is going to contain that gene of interest. I talk about cloning, but the first cloning of an organism was actually done in carrots by dividing out to individual cells of carrot roots and then taking those cells and culturing them into new ones. So it's the same technology thing. And you get a plant now that has a gene from a foreign source, whatever it is you spliced in there. These are some reasons that plants have been modified. The little ones are sort of remind me what ones I want to talk about. But they've been modified. The first plants to be genetically modified and field tested were strawberries and potatoes in the same year. And they were modified by placing genes from cold-tolerant organisms into these particular plants. Pardon me while I look at my notes so I can actually tell you where those came from. I'm calling them antifreeze genes. I don't know if that's actually the right term. But some of these genes have been taken from flounders, which exist in very cold waters, and so putting fish genes into these plants. Some of the genes have been from carrots. Carrots, as you probably know, survive the cold very well. You can leave them in Salem. My wife leaves them in the garden all winter, and we can eat them all winter. Of course, it doesn't get too cold, but and also there's I don't know exactly what this organism is. It's a mealworm of some sort called a yellow mealworm whose larvae are maintained in a frozen environment over winter. And so genes from this, so there we have three different sources of genes that have been put into these particular plants to increase frost resistance. Basically what they do is that frost, it's the ice crystal formation that damages the plant. The ice crystal formation will damage the cell wall of the plant. And what these genes do is they produce proteins that are expressed on the outside of the plant that that interact with water and prevent it from forming ice crystals. You have to have a little nucleus to form ice crystals and prevent that ice nucleus formation. Another reason for modification is to control ripening and better shelf life. This has not been so successful. The first crop that this really was utilized on in the 1980s were tomatoes and the production of a tomato called Flavor Saver. And a Flavor Saver tomato had a gene that prevented the breakdown of pectin, which is the substance that holds the structure together, the cell walls together, and when that breaks down, that's how rot begins. And so it was a rot-resistant tomato. And it could be left on the vines longer. Instead of picking it as a green tomato and shipping it off to the grocer, it could ripen on the vines, get a vine-ripened tomato, and then it would store longer on the shelf, on the grocer's shelf, because of the rot resistance. They ran into some problems. They weren't thinking ahead too much. But one of the problems that in the commercial tomato fields are mechanically picked, and the mechanical pickers were not successful in picking these soft, ripened tomatoes. And so for economical reasons, that didn't work, and there were some other issues, and it lasted on the market for about 1 year and disappeared. The potato here, reference is to something that it's not really ripening or shelf life, but you know how you peel a potato and you leave it out in the air, it turns brown. And it's because of an oxidation product within that oxygen in the atmosphere and one of the chemicals in the potato. Well, there are efforts being made to inactivate that oxidase, that enzyme that interacts with the organic molecules of the potato and oxidize it and turn it brown. And so if that could be inactivated, I guess it's just a aesthetic property, but it would prevent that browning. I'm not sure exactly which species have been had ripening studies done on them, but the idea here is that many crops, as you know, will ripen, fruits, let's say, will ripen at different times. And if that could be controlled hormonally, and a lot of ripening is due to a molecule called ethylene. If you could control the production of ethylene so that it would be inhibited until something is done to activate its production, perhaps a spray of some kind of activating substance, then that would stimulate ripening simultaneously. So for harvesting purposes, you will go through your berry field once instead of multiple times and get it all at one time. And especially if it's a crop that's mechanically harvested, you get better yields. There have been great successes in the next two. Pest resistance, the first and most common gene that is involved in pest resistance is one for a toxin from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis. Thuringiensis, maybe another syllable in there. This is a bacterium, a spore-producing bacterium, that initially was utilized, and still is utilized this way, but utilizes it as an insecticide that you can buy this at your local garden store for home use, the spores of this organism. And when those spores germinate and bacteria are produced, they produce a toxin. It's a toxin that is very specific. It's a targeted toxin in that the organisms that are affected by it are the larvae of lepidopterans. Lepidopterans are moths and butterflies, and the larvae are the caterpillars. And when the caterpillars ingest this toxin, it basically dissolves their gastrointestinal tract and kills them. Okay? And it's very specific to those organisms. It's been utilized very successfully against, in this area, and I'm not sure, Washington had gypsy moth problems in the past, and Oregon has. It's been utilized against gypsy moths. It is utilized against a corn boring a corn larva of some sort. It's used on cotton, and it's used on canola, or has been historically. But what now has happened is that those crops I just mentioned, many of those have been converted, been transformed transgenically by having that gene inserted. And when that gene is inserted, then the tissue of the plant has that toxin. And so if the moth comes and chomps on that leaf, it's going to ingest the toxin that you have. Now, I've got some statistics. I've got a slide later that will bring some of this back together and summarize it. But 15% of all biotech crops have BT genes in them. And it's been estimated that if this gene is inserted in corn in general, that it would save farmers $1 billion a year in the United States. Major problem. Herbicide resistance, the other one here is tomato mosaic virus, sorry. Mm-hmm. And some similar ones, there's a cantaloupe mosaic virus and there's something else that have, for which crops have become resistant for that virus and the idea. Yes?
By inserting the genes, has it changed the product?
That's a good point. It's going to produce a new substance. And this is where the controversy comes in, right? It's going to produce a new substance, and then what is the nature of that substance and what's it going to do? Well, when you get done with the plant product, I'm going to come back to a slide with what the FDA says. Okay? Okay. And as many of you probably know, genetically modified foodstuffs have become very controversial, and in Europe, they've basically been banned. And there's been some problem in Japan with them. I know it's been a real controversy down in Oregon with the wheat farmers because they sell so much product to Japan. And Japan a couple years ago said, we don't want any genetically modified wheat coming.
There's a lot of BT genes in our agricultural crops.
Yes, there are. There are a lot of them. And we're going to find out in a minute that in some crops, there are many more of these, and these are even a bigger potential problem.
Yeah.
Somebody here had it.
Are the seeds then carry the genetic change?
The feeds?
The seeds.
Seeds. Yes. And it depends on how they're engineered, but if they're engineered by planting, putting them in those single seed cells to grow up crops that then produce seeds? The answer is yes, the seeds have it.
And how about the pollen that would blow into other people's fields?
Yes, and that's the other major, one of the major concerns, that the pollen and, especially with this one, which I get to in a second, is the pollen, and that's been a concern. And let me come back to that question when I talk about the herbicide one and get to that, and then make sure I answer your question because there's some work being done to resolve that issue.
The other point, I guess, that I've done some reading on is spinoff problems. You know, if you eliminate food sources for songbirds and then problems with monarch butterflies and some of the genetically modified corn, things like that.
Sure. I mean, food webs are so complicated that you really, it's very difficult to predict when you perturb them what's going to happen. You do something down here at the base of a food chain that doesn't look like it directly affects, say, some bird species, but you find out ultimately it does because of changes in the food supply, et cetera. Yeah, the ecologists have lots of fun. I'm not an ecologist, but there's just a tremendous amount of work being done on, mostly by mathematical modeling, these very complex food webs, because there's food. We talk about food chains in introductory biology courses. You know, the grass uses the sun, and something eats the grass. The deer eat the grass, and the cougars eat the deer. And those, you know, we talk about different trophic levels and all of that. But that's so oversimplified. But you have all of these linear intersecting common prey and all of that, and so it's very hard to predict what a perturbation in a food chain does. It's a good point. The herbicide-resistant one is the one I think we hear the most about in some sense. Herbicide resistance, and especially for the herbicide Roundup, glyphosate is its chemical name, but Roundup pretty much kills everything, right? You want to get rid of something, spray Roundup on it. It's kind of tough, you know. Blackberries take a lot of work. Other than that, but and the development of what Roundup Ready is the name of the gene, was developed by Monsanto. Monsanto makes Roundup, and the transgenic organisms were developed by Monsanto, and again, these are basically corn. Let's see, you can help me with it, maybe. Corn, canola,
soybeans,
a big one. Thank you. That's the first one. That's the yes. Thank you. I knew there was one that was very important that I didn't have, and that's the major one. So Monsanto produced these transgenic seeds that have a Roundup-resistant property, an enzyme that breaks down glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. The advantage of that is now you want to weed your crop. You don't go out and manually weed between the rows or run your tractor between the rows. You can aerial spray Roundup across your cornfield, 100 acres of corn, 1,000 acres of corn, whatever. It'll kill everything else except the crop. The corn. Okay.
How about the where the mist blows on the things you don't want to be killed?
It'll kill those too. Right, right. But 80%, the latest statistic I saw, 80% of the soybeans grown in the United States have Roundup resistant genes. 80%. 95% of the soybeans grown in Argentina have Roundup Ready genes.
How long does that Roundup stay in the soil?
I don't think Roundup is persistent itself. No. I think it's got a relatively short half-life. It's like a couple of weeks maybe or less.
Yeah.
Or less than that. You can spray it within a few days you can use crops. Yeah. So it doesn't stay.
You can plant another crop next year on that soil that is not resistant.
Right, right. Now the other thing that Monsanto is, and there's also another one, another herbicide that I'm not that familiar with called Bromoxynil. or something of that sort. I don't know what its trade name is. It's a different chemical company. It's not Monsanto derived, but it's the same idea. It's another herbicide. But what Monsanto has done, if you're a farmer and you want to buy their seed, you have to sign a contract that says you will not use the seeds from that crop for your next year's crop. Okay. In other words, they make you contractually agree to buy seeds from them annually. Okay. Of course, not everybody obeys the contracts they sign. And I found some statistics here recently that. I'm going to wait for a slide, and I'll probably misquote it. It's going to come up on a slide.
Does Japan allow the importation of Roundup Ready soy?
I don't know the answer to that question.
It seemed like I read somewhere they didn't, which was they're being pounded on to allow that.
I think that's probably right, because they've outlawed the entry of other genetically modified plants, so I would guess that's true. Now, in order to avoid the contractual cheating on the contract, Monsanto has proposed the insertion of a second gene called a terminator gene or something of that sort, which will then make those seeds inactive so they can't be used in the future. Now, your question has to do with maybe even pollen drifting around. So one of the concerns now with the herbicide-resistant plants, and there are so many of them, with the herbicide-resistant plants is potential production of what people are calling super weeds. So you get cross-pollination with something similar, and you've transferred that gene into some other plant that now becomes resistant. Now, there is a potential solution to that problem, and the potential solution to that problem relates to the fact that not all genes in plants or in animals reside in the nucleus. There are two organelles in cells that have DNA, mitochondria, which are involved in energy conversions in cells. We all have thousands of mitochondria in each of our cells. That's where we get our ATP for energy to drive our energy-requiring processes. But plants also have chlorophyll, the photosynthetic organelle. And that has its own DNA. Both those organelles have their own DNA. They're self-replicating. They express the DNA in the organelles. And if that chloroplast could be modified, now there would not be a problem if that was the modified organelle instead of nuclear genes, because pollen doesn't have chloroplast. So when pollen is produced, the organelles do not get packaged into the pollen. And so the gene would not transfer to pollen. It would be in the eggs, the ovules, but it wouldn't transfer to pollen. So there is work being done on changing the format of those kinds of plants that are Roundup Ready or something similar. So there is a fix for that, at least for that part of the controversy. Other issues still remain. Let's move on. Nutritional value can be increased. We like canola oil. Why do we like canola oil?
Because it's kind of good for you.
It's kind of good for us. It's got the saturated fat content, etc. It's more like olive oil. Turns out, and I didn't know this until recently as I was preparing some of this material, it turns out that canola, wild-type canola, doesn't have that property.
What kind doesn't?
What I call wild-type, non-modified
kind.
Oh, it doesn't. The former rapeseed back, 20, 25 years ago, did not produce the kind of oil that we want. And it's produced because of a transgene that, see if I can quickly find where it came from. But it's been modified to produce the kind of fatty acids in their oils that we want. And it's had a 40% level. I remember the number, I don't remember the source. Here we go. It came from California Bay Laurel. California Bay Laurel produces a substance called lauric acid, is named from it. Lauric acid, which is about 40% of the content of canola oil, low in saturated fat, and that's what has made canola oil be the product that we use and want to use because of its low saturated fat content. It's a transgenic gene out of California Bay Laurel producing the kind of product that we buy canola.
Would organically grown canola oil not have that property?
Organically grown, if it's the seeds of standard canola that are now genetically modified, it would have this property.
But if they're seeds that are the old-fashioned seeds, that would...
Yeah, you probably have to go back 25 years to get those old-fashioned seeds, though.
You don't want the old-fashioned.
No, you don't want the old-fashioned.
No, I mean, but I was wondering if you bought the old...
It tastes like turpentine.
Oh, yes? Okay, thank you.
Well, coming from Saskatoon, there's a little canola around.
Oh, yes. There's a little canola. You drive up there, the fields are all yellow.
Right. And so that was the big breakthrough with canola, when they were able to put in this particular gene, which actually made it edible. Before then, you would not want canola. It would hardly be edible.
It was used as animal gene, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rice, I'll show you a picture and make comment about rice in a minute. My last bullet down here is more development into the future. Not so much there yet, but one of the goals is familiar with legumes that are nitrogen fixers and live off of 70-some% nitrogen in the atmosphere. Nitrogen's often a limiting nutrient in terrestrial environments, so we put nitrogen fertilizers on our crops. And the legumes that can utilize nitrogen from the atmosphere have been the basis for crop rotation historically, because they fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and then when you turn them under and you let them decompose, that nitrogen gets into the soil for your next year's crop. And the nitrogen fixing process, many people are working on ways to put nitrogen-fixing genes into other crop species. It would be very difficult because it's a large biochemical process. It's not a single enzyme, a single gene, maybe a whole family of genes. But that's, in some people's mind, would be very useful. Golden rice, you can see the difference here. Golden rice is a rice that has beta-carotene gene. Beta carotene is the substance that gives carrots their color. And beta carotene is a large organic molecule. If you cut it in half, make two identical halves of it, chemically cut it in half, it's vitamin A. Okay, so this is the source of vitamin A, and we've all heard the story. Eat carrots if you want good night vision. Okay, and vitamin A is converted to retinol, which is a pigment in the eye. And, so this is truth, some basis for that comment.
What do you mean cut it in half?
Oh, chemically. It's a molecule that has about 80 carbon atoms in it. If you can cleave it so into two molecules of that are 40 carbon atoms long instead of 80 carbon atoms long, you convert it into a vitamin. It's just chemically related to two vitamins stuck together, basically.
So I don't have to cut everyone.
No, you don't cut. Yeah. You don't cut. No. We cut it metabolically. Some of the color, I think, beta carotene is color, but it doesn't produce this much color. And the color, so you can distinguish it from normal rice, is actually due to genes from daffodils. I had some statistics here on vitamin A deficiency. That according to the World Health Organization, vitamin A deficiency is a problem in 118 different countries of the world. contributing to between a quarter and a half a million cases of blindness annually, and an estimate that upwards of 140 million children in the world don't get enough vitamin A. And of course, rice is a major food substance, and that was the purpose, is the purpose for the production of this rice, is to increase the nutritional content of the rice, especially rice that is being produced or shipped to developing countries.
Was that the feeling, did they feel the market would want a way to recognize the golden rice, the reason why they added the daffodil?
I think probably also so you can differentiate whether or not it has that added beta carotene. I think that the color would difference. I mean, it just really
sure
gives you a tag that says, I look at this, I know that this is the nutritional supplement in rice.
So is vitamin A easy or to do that with, or could they do that with other vitamins?
They could probably do that with other vitamins too. It's just that this is one where there was a major problem according to the World Health Organization, and there was some reason to develop, probably some funding from World Health Organization to develop it. This is what the Federal Food and Drug Administration says about genetically modified foods, that they do not have to be labeled as such in this country by federal law. These state laws may vary, if they're treated as conventional foods if nutritional value has not been lowered, if known foreign kinds of organic substances and molecules result in it, as you can add proteins or carbohydrates and lipids, things of that sort, and that they are not allergenic. You can produce allergies, we don't have allergies against them. Now, according to federal law, if that's not true, they have to be treated specially, I suppose, and labeled. Some states will now probably require labeling.
I think my question relates to this. When a company like Monsanto or the different corporations producing some of these new foods put a new food on the market, they test it obviously against, like, for example, does it produce the right, that was it the BT gene that produces the toxin in the worm that you want? Do they also have to test to see what are the effects in humans and how humans can digest it? It's kind of an obvious question, right? But do they have to?
My impression is they do not have to. Because they're not, it's a protein, and we, you know, metabolically, we ingest proteins, and we break them down in our intestinal tract and destroy the protein itself. I mean, we convert proteins to their amino acid subunits before we can absorb them. And protein, we digest proteins generally, and so that a protein product, theoretically, should not cause problem unless it's something that is binds on the outer surface, let's say, of intestinal cells and is toxic. Because it will not be absorbed. It's too large a molecule, proteins, too large a molecule to be absorbed into the bloodstream. Okay, so they have to be broken down into their subunits, and that destroys them. It's the three-dimensional shape of the protein.
I know David Suzuki, who you know, is a Canadian geneticist so he knows all about genes, but he's really highly critical of putting these things on the market without having done any of the research, how does that actually affect human beings? And so why not? Or not working even with the chemical scientists who understand the chemistry of how humans digest things, and also the Monsanto ready things. I guess that would be my question. How do we absorb it, and what are the long term?
Right, and again, it's a protein, so it's the same kind of issue. It's an enzyme that breaks down glyphosate, which is the ingredient. So, this is why these are controversial. These are why these are controversial. And, you know, what's going to happen in the next few years politically?
It seems like the law is on their side, not assuming that it's benign rather than having them prove that it's benign.
Do you know what the situation is in Canada on these issues? Is it pretty much the same? Do you know?
I don't think that they have to market. Although I've heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but that the little label that you see on a piece of fruit, there's a number at the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's four, it's conventionally produced. Mm-hmm. If it's 8, it's organic, and if it's 9, it's genetically modified. Something
like that. Yeah. So at least you know whether or not it is.
You know that if you're, I've been looking, but they have to mark it as GMO.
But there's
I've never seen it. Yeah.
There's a huge
discussion
reluctance
about it happening in the future, but not yet. Pardon me?
I was going to say, there's a huge reluctance in the United States to even label foods. Congress just defeated a bill, or tabled it, basically, that was going to require the labeling of a country of origin for meats. Mm-hmm. And that got blocked. And to me, if there's money to be made, like Monsanto has made with soybeans, it'll come out on the market before we know it. There was that modified fat that they put in potato chips that came out about 2 years ago.
Right.
And that made a lot of people sick.
Very sick, yeah.
So that came out, was heralded as a great thing, and then went away real quick. But
there's still some of it on the market.
Is there?
Yeah, isn't it? I can't remember the what
you remember.
They market.
You flush that in the intestinal tract rather than absorb.
Right, but it causes gastrointestinal problems, diarrhea, things. This is my last slide on this, and we probably aren't going to have time to really talk about animals, but I only had about two things to say anyway. We'll see where we are. Just some things on the Roundup Ready that I dug out of some of the recent articles. The number of acres of Roundup Ready crops, 200 million acres in 17 different countries, 8 million farms using them. Of that 200 acres, 117 million of them are in the United States. And what, 40 million in Argentina and 13 in Canada, and these are in decreasing order of use, but the Argentina and United States mostly. Monsanto has recently filed suit against 147 farmers and 29 large agricultural companies for contract violations of reusing the seeds. And one of the farms was awarded Monsanto was awarded a $1.7 million judgment. This is an estimate of what using pesticide and herbicide, pesticide resistant genes, what kinds of savings there could be to the agricultural community where there says none available, it said means that there is no alternative, thank you, at this point. And there's nothing available to fight these particular, it's a papaya virus of some sort. There's no known treatment at this, method to prevent it at this point, and that the whole crop in Hawaii is liable to be lost, which would be a $17 million potential loss. Same for the citrus in Texas, Florida, and et cetera. But you see the number of pounds of pesticides that estimated could be saved, not used, by using these kinds of plants. So 2.7 million pounds of pesticides being used in the cotton fields in the United States annually, costing the farmers $99 million, et cetera. So let's give you some idea of the economic potential benefit, at least to those that are growing the crops. Forget this. There's a couple of new ideas. That was a couple of ways to propagate these genes without being produced, without going through the same recombinant technology. Just to mention in the last couple of minutes here, something about transgenic animals. We all know that build a better mousetrap in the world will be a path to your door. In the 1980s, a lot of people started saying, just build a better mouse. And the first transgenic animals were produced in 1981, where a growth hormone gene from rats were transferred into mice. And these are, if they will click in, are litter mates that are genetically the same, with the exception of the one on the left has the growth hormone gene. This is the first experiment of transferring genes producing transgenic animals, in this case mice. mice have been used for many different reasons, transgenically. I don't know what that other one is. I don't know if that slide had anything on it, importance or not. Oh, it just shows, thank you, it shows how genes are introduced into the nucleus of a cell. There's a cell, it could be a fertilized egg. In animals, it would typically be the situation as opposed to the plants where you could just put them in an annual cell and then grow a plant from them. But usually a fertilized egg, and you clone the genes by all the techniques we talked about yesterday if you were here. You make multiple copies of the gene and then actually surgically insert them into the nucleus with a very fine needle, a syringe needle essentially. What it is, it's a glass rod. You heat up a glass tube and pull it out to a fine hair. And these little pipettes, or whatever you want to call them, are thinner than human hair, about 1/100 the diameter of human hair. There's devices called micromanipulators that you attach to microscopes so you can move these very precisely. This is just a little suction thing to hold the egg in place while you're doing it. You can actually penetrate through the egg into the nucleus, squirt in a bunch of genes, and then hope that some of those genes get incorporated into the chromosome of the egg. That's a typical way that you go about producing transgenic animal. And, the previous slide that is coming back right now, just simply really quickly shows you some of the kinds of transgenic mice that have been produced and why we might want to produce them. They've been produced to mimic human disease conditions, to study the diseases, breast cancer, prostate cancer, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and others. But these are some of the biggies that we have. There are strains of mice available that are susceptible to all of these conditions. And so you can study the disease in these animals using them as an animal model and trying to hope that the parallelism is there to humans. There are mice that have complete human immune systems. They were not developed by the same technology, but they're modified so they have the same white blood cell composition as we have. They produce antibodies, same as we do. They can be used for studying especially something like AIDS, which is where the virus attacks the helper T cells, which are kind of white blood cell. And there are many of them that have what we call knockout, and these are animals that have a particular gene that you can specifically at a particular time by some kind of an outer environmental stimulus inactivate and knock the gene out. And then you can study, well, what happens to an animal that is normal with the exception of this one particular gene, to try to understand the function of that gene. Transgenic animals that produce human proteins. Yesterday, those of you that were here, we talked a lot about insulin production by bacteria. Here we have human proteins of various kinds being produced by various kinds of transgenic animals. Pigs that produce human hemoglobin, cows that produce lactoferrin, which is an iron transport molecule, especially important in breast milk. Goats, the antithrombin is a blood clot inhibitor. The next one has to do with carbohydrate metabolism problem where the liver doesn't break down stored glycogen and allow the glucose, the blood sugar, to enter the bloodstream. This is an agent that is useful in combating emphysema. Next one, cystic fibrosis. It's a treatment for cystic fibrosis. It's the molecule that is non-functional in cystic fibrosis, which is due to a single gene, and vaccines of various kinds is just an example. These are animals, and this is where the transgenic animals come into two categories. Those that are used for research purposes, like the previous slide, and those that are used by pharmaceutical companies to produce some kind of a human product. And they do this by linking the gene for that product to the casein gene. The casein is milk protein. And so these products are secreted into the milk of these animals, where it can then relatively easily be purified, from which it can be purified. One statistic on this molecule for emphysema treatment is that it would take only, well, 3.5 times 5 is 15, 17.5 liters of milk for an annual supply for a single patient. And that's not that much milk. You know. So, And that probably brings us to closure. You want an animal that glows in the dark, or glows green? Actually, there's a reason for this. These are some mice that have a luciferin gene or something, I believe it is. Also, there's a jellyfish gene called green fluorescent protein. The protein product is that fluoresces. And the reason for these is usually to link that to a transgene, so you know if the transgene was taken up by the animal, is that you can then irradiate them usually. In this case, I think you irradiate them with blue light with gene fluorescent protein, which I play around a little bit with in my labs in transferring it into bacteria. It's a jellyfish gene. You ultraviolet radiate them and they glow green. And there's an animal that was born in the mid-90s, the first primate to have an inserted gene. It's a rhesus monkey called, his name is Andy. A-N-D, little I, capital A, capital N, capital A, little I. I guess I said that wrong, but that's right. And if you turn it around, it's I-DNA, inserted DNA. And it's a rhesus monkey, first primate to have this. And I guess it had to be in 89, not in the 90s, because in 91 we were putting them into humans, of a gene into humans. And it was done at Oregon Regional Primate Center, the little rhesus monkey. Yeah. If you shine ultraviolet light on it, it glows green.
This gene would be inserted in the egg?
That's right.
And would that be from one litter of animals, some got inserted and some didn't?
That's right. The insertion frequency is low. Yeah. And when we talk about cloning tomorrow, I have some data on the success rate of cloning. Everybody's familiar with Dolly the sheep. Mm-hmm. Took 277 trials.
Do you ever think about the butterfly? I can't think of it. Butterfly reaction came from a story many years ago. The butterfly effect. They had people going back into history. You had to stay on the path, and one guy stepped off and came back, and everything was different.
Everything.
And he looked at his shoe, and he had a butterfly on it.
I don't know the butterfly effect. So watch out for butterflies on shoes? No.
But I mean, just that we can never tell
That's right. You know, think about how many things have gone astray. You know, we develop something for a useful purpose,
right,
and it hasn't worked out. Yeah, no, you don't.
Will some of this go the way of the DDT? Will some of this go the way of the DDT?
I guess we don't know, but it could. We could, I mean, sure, that's a good example of something that was produced for a very useful purpose and it was very successful. And what were ecological ramifications about? Wiped out the raptor crop, or the eagles, and the osprey, and many other species.
But I'm thinking not only of that, but I'm thinking of food and our consumption, mm-hmm, and our human bodies.
I guess we don't know the answer to those, you know, we do the best we can.
Thank God we have a big liver.
Some of us have bigger livers than others of us.
Maybe it will mutate and get larger ones.
I'll have to talk to you about David Suzuki later. He had some wild ideas in the past.
I figure there must be a logical reason why Europe has banned GMO products, and I wonder what that is.
I don't know if there's a logical reason. Where's my... you know that... There's some interesting things that, you know, I saw statistics last week. This is a little bit different from what you're saying, but questioning Americans, would you eat beef from a cloned cow? 62% said no. American thoughts, these aren't European thoughts. Belief that genetically modified food products are required to be labeled in the United States, although that just had to do with what people thought about it. Belief that GM, people just don't understand where we are on these. You know, 28% said they had to be labeled, 33% they did before he said they didn't know. Question came up, are they tested for environmental safety? 23% of the population said yes. They aren't necessarily, yeah. But we just don't know enough about them. Now, why did Europe, do the Europeans not want them? Maybe it's to protect their own, you know, one reason could be to protect their own agriculture. If they can't bring them in, you know, they're not going to flood the market with crops from other countries. I don't know if that's it.
There's such an increase in ADD in children. Could some of this stuff have?
Well, I think the increase probably preceded a lot of this, though, did it not? I don't know.
I don't know. It seems to me there's more and more. I haven't read the statistics, but I did read a study about some fifth grade school children, and they did a test on all of the chemicals and stuff that were in the children's urine. And there was only one child that had a very, very low amount of pesticide. And that was a child who was on organic food. The parents only ate organic food.
Well, therefore, you had less pesticides, so that would correspond.
Well, DDT is still used throughout the world. Mm-hmm. It just banned in the United States. It's used all over South America. Mm-hmm. And there's some studies of Inuits in Alaska that have the highest concentrations in breast milk of any people in the Northern Hemisphere because of the drift patterns and the biological magnification.
Yeah, I would say that probably their diets would...
Fish?
Yeah.
Whale?
Right.
Yeah, they're
so
picking
they
it up in the fat, right?
So it's still a problem.
Yeah, you know, we're kind of a little island when it comes to some of the pesticides mm-hmm. that are used all over the world.
Right.
Oh, we've run 10 minutes over. I'm going to get chastised, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.